You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Advances in the Delayed Onset of Type 1 Diabetes, Strategies to Improve Awareness and Care for the Practicing Clinician. I'm Deb Gordon from Med Learning Group, and I'm joined today by Dr. Brett McQueen, who directs the Center for Pharmaceutical Value at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus in Denver. He's here to discuss issues important to payers around the use of screening for type 1 diabetes and the first therapy to slow the progression from stage 2 to stage 3 diabetes. Welcome, Dr. McQueen.
Thank you.
You know, when we talk diabetes in this country, we're almost always talking type 2 in terms of costs to the healthcare systems, patients, and employers. Let's talk a little bit, though, about the economic impact of type 1 diabetes. What can you tell us there?
Yeah, it's slightly different than type 2 in a couple of different ways. And I like to first explain the challenge from the patient perspective, which is significant and really starts with this day-to-day issue of mortality, always hanging over someone's head without access to insulin and glucagon. And those two things, you know, are just paramount to staying alive for a patient with type 1. And then you have all of that balanced against the long run complications with glycemic control changes. So the worse controlled you are earlier in life, the more that will affect both your survival and morbidity later in life. And then when you look at it from the payer perspective, while it's low prevalence compared to, say, type 2, you have this situation where most patients cost a lot more than type 2 because of the more enhanced glycemic control techniques, such as continuous glucose monitoring. You also have intensive insulin use and more provider visits than type 2. So that usually adds up to more spending from the payer view just to keep the disease managed.
Well, today we are focusing a lot on screening for type 1 diabetes, both in terms of risk as well as stage, because we now have a therapy that can delay the transition from stage 2 to stage 3, which, as we know, stage 3 is insulin dependent. You did a fascinating paper on the cost and cost effectiveness of large-scale screening based on the results of the ASK study that was done there in your institution. What was the ASK study? And then how did you take that data to look at the impact on payers?
Yeah, the ASK study was all comers. So general population children were screened and are still ongoing screening. In fact, my toddler was screened recently in the ASK program. And they have a upfront four-panel test for islet autoantibodies as well as for celiac disease. And they test each participant. There's a consent form that parents can sign, and it's actually moving outside of Colorado now, but it started just in the metro Denver area and then has sort of expanded as the success has continued. When we wrote the paper in 2020, there were 10,000 that had been screened. Shortly after that, there were 30,000 and so forth. So there's an exponential growth in those who are screened. And what we ended up doing in our 2020 paper was demonstrating the cost effectiveness potential of general population screening with islet autoantibody panel testing, using two different prices. So right now there's a reimbursement price from CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And then separately, there's a research cost that was used that was essentially discounted. And that's because the ASK program has actual, you know, they have lab scientists that can create these tests on their own. And so it's really just almost a cost of production. So we looked at both of those prices and then were able to sort of find how would the cost effectiveness picture differ if it were the lower cost of production all the way up to the reimbursement price. And that allows us to do what we like to do, called scenario analyses, where you know, where maybe is the middle point, the point of truth of what would be most cost effective, and can we suggest that to public health decision makers? For example, are you willing to pay X dollars? If you're willing to pay that, it will be cost effective and potentially even affordable from a budget impact perspective. Instead of walking into screening saying this is automatically going to be cost effective because we just don't have the answer and it would take 50 years to generate the answer, but we can use surrogate outcomes to help us extrapolate those benefits and those costs over longer time horizons to help us sort of understand what are the value points for payers to understand this sort of broad large-scale screening, because really the problem is you're going to screen essentially everyone in the population, or at least a majority of the population, depending on the strategy. It's more just how do you balance all of those upfront spending costs on screening against those potential benefits in the future. The idea would be, one, to reduce DKA events, which are very expensive, but previous evidence, and we confirm this, really suggests that it's not going to be cost effective just to avoid the DKA event alone. But we did find pretty significant evidence around the world, as well as at the Barbara Davis Center at the University of Colorado, where patients that had a DKA event had just different glycemic control over longer time periods than others that did not have a DKA event. And it was persistent out to 15 years. And it wasn't a U.S. healthcare system issue, because we're seeing it in other countries around the world, which is really important. So what we did in our paper was essentially provide a scenario to say how much benefit would we have to give, both in terms of DKA event reduction, as well as improvements in glycemic control. And it turns out it's a fairly modest reductions in both, or I should say a modest reduction in a DKA event, as well as modest improvements in HbA1c. And that could be determined through, or that could be achieved through early behaviors. So, you know, getting on track with good behaviors starts very early for type 1 diabetes patients. And also getting on technology like continuous glucose monitoring or even hybrid closed loop systems early will just benefit patients over the course of their entire lifetime.
And my understanding is you've got a follow-up to it.
In our follow-up, what we're actually doing is working more on a variety of different screening strategies. So that could be islet autoantibody, that could be genetic risk score screening, and it could be combinations of the two.
And if so, you know, was it cost-effective?
Well, we actually use 100,000 per, and it depends. There's per life year gain, and there's also per quality-adjusted life year gain. There's a separate legislation that has restricted the use of quality adjusted life years as an outcome. That's for probably out of scope from this podcast, but
yeah.
Generally at the 100,000 per quality threshold and per life year threshold, which we used in the ADA talk that I just gave a couple of weeks ago, we're finding that if you reach 20% reductions in DKA from current DKA ratios of, say, half of every person that's diagnosed between the ages of 2 and 18, about half are coming in and they're going to the ED, they're going to the hospital for very expensive events. There's an increased risk of mortality. There are obviously added costs. And then if you drop that by about 20% down to the 30% or lower mark in terms of the ratio of who has DKA, paired with glycemic control improvements of 0.1%, you do reach cost effectiveness thresholds at both of those prices that I mentioned earlier, the cost of production as well as the reimbursement price.
Very interesting. And we do know that screening can reduce the risk of DKA from 40 or 50% down to 5%. So that we do know. Fascinating. When we talk about screening, often there is this discussion of the impact on mortality. Is that a discussion from the public health perspective we need to be having when it comes to type 1 diabetes? It's not like we're screening for a cancer. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because the mortality component, while there is a small reduction in mortality from avoiding DKA events, generally our healthcare system has gotten really good at treating DKA in a way where we can keep children alive. So the mortality doesn't actually come into play until much later. And what I presented at the American Diabetes Association 84th scientific sessions in Orlando was that if you were to screen at current levels and you had the performance of the different screening approaches included in the effectiveness that you spoke about, the 5 to around 10% of what we're finding around the world, you'd really be in a good position in terms of cost effectiveness and improvements in life. And what I mean by that is you'd have both cost offsets. So you'd have reduced progression into some of these complications, or what I'll say is delayed progression into some of the complication states, which in the end saves you money over a lifetime. And then you also would gain about a year on average of life for a population, for each person on average, which would add up to a lot if you, even if there's, say, only 1,000 people in a health plan with type 1 diabetes out of 100,000, that's 1,000 life years gained. It's a lot. That's a lot of population health gain. So there is a survival component that we've modeled out, we've extrapolated. It's just that we won't really know the real answer to that for 40 or 50 years. And we have to make decisions now, which is the importance of some of those long-run studies that linked glycemic control to survival. So that's what we're relying on to do those calculations.
Well, we now have as we discussed earlier, a therapy approved in patients 8 and older to delay the onset of stage 3 type 1 diabetes, teplizumab. It's not cheap. It's about $194,000 for the 14-day treatment. What do payers need to know about it? Have you looked at the cost effectiveness of the treatment?
That is something we're proposing to work on in the near future. I think from the back of the envelope perspective, which I've sort of done on a napkin, and so to speak, is really to look at how cost effective it would be in a general population. Because right now, the drug was studied in patients with, you know, family relatives with type 1. No one in the placebo group or in the treatment group had a severe DKA event. It's really hard to assess cost effectiveness when you're already in a very well-controlled population. This happens all the time with approvals of new therapies where the trial was done in a, you know, much smaller cohort than what would be in real world. So that's something that we're proposing to study in the future using patients who've actually taken teplizumab at the Barbara Davis Center at the University of Colorado. So we will see about that in the future. That depends on funding and the number of people that are infused. But that'll be a really fascinating question. And a roundabout way to answer your question is to say, you know, what payers really need to know is how long the delay will be and whether there will be actual prevention. And I think that's when we start getting into cost-effective scenarios, when you start adding up more than 2 years, you know, somewhere in the 5 to 10 years. And if you can actually prevent type 1, at least among a small proportion of those patients, you will reach levels of cost effectiveness. At least that's my prediction.
But we do know that in some of the people who receive the drug, we're looking 6 years out and they're still doing pretty well. So it's delayed. So that there is that possibility. And I know there's studies looking at its potential for prevention as well as other drugs. This has been great. What have I not asked you about in terms of what payers need to know in about screening and type 1 delay, possibly prevention? Anything else you want to get across?
I think what I've heard generally from payers has been type 1 is already such a low prevalent condition, and they're really looking at budget impact overall for their whole health plan. And the way they view this is you and I each cost a certain amount to the health plan. Some of us spend nothing on healthcare, others spend a lot. And when looking at premiums, they have to look at everyone's contribution to the pot of money available for healthcare. So when looking at type 1, you see a small population, very expensive, but there's also no alternative for these patients other than just waiting. Wait to see. And so I think for the vast majority of payers, it likely won't have an effect on their overall budget. That said, we have heard of some exclusions. And, you know, that is probably in part due to uncertain evidence on benefits, given the small scale study, which is would be naturally occurring in any low prevalent condition. And then the upfront cost of the screening. So we have to not only pay for the screening, but now we have to also pay for the therapy. And I think that would be, that's an area where I've heard some red flags. But in the end, I think the concept of unmet need will win out with the majority of payers, and they'll see there's really no other alternative. And therefore, they'll likely remove most restrictions. Again, that's for a number of payers. It's not for every single one of the payers.
Wonderful answer. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for that most informative discussion. And I want to thank all our listeners. I hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. We have 4 more. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. In support of improving patient care, Med Learning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team.